Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, veteran historian, journalist, and author Fergus Borderwick talks about his latest book, Klan Wars, Ulysses S. Grant and the Battle to Save Reconstruction. It was published in October 2023 by Knopf, and it documents the history of the Ku Klux Klan and Ulysses Grant's presidency. Fergus Borderwick was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member John Farrell.
So, Fergus, I picked up this wonderful book and started to read it, and I kept waiting for scenes from Ulysses Grant's childhood or his battle at the Wilderness. And as I was reading, all of a sudden the thought occurred to me that this is not a biography of Ulysses Grant. This is a biography of the Ku Klux Klan. And that's the birth story that's included in it. Why did you make this choice? How did you come about picking the birth of the Klan for a topic? And does it by any chance have anything to do, as you sort of hint a couple of times in the book, with the insurrections of January 6th?
Well, gosh, that's about 3.5 questions.
There you go.
Take
all the time you want.
So I will wend my way through those.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting way of putting it. It's a story about the birth of the Klan. That's true. It's life and death, finally, in the 19th century. We're, of course, talking here about the original Klan of the 1860s and 70s, not the 20th century version, which is rather different. However, the book really did begin with a focus on Grant, but it became incumbent on me to really explain what the Klan was, what this monster was that he was wrestling with once he became president, and that it had been founded several years before Grant had a chance to come to grips with it. And he wasn't able to do so until he became president. And I didn't think it was necessary at all to talk about Grant's early life. There's plenty that we know about that now. And I think I brushed in what I thought was necessary to know, which is to say his father was an abolitionist. Yeah. He had a very interesting trajectory in relation to African Americans and slavery. He grew a lot. But he started from a comparatively enlightened base for a kid who grew up on the Ohio River and was not political and not himself an abolitionist. His evolution was fairly dramatic and ultimately dynamic. So Grant is present for me from the beginning.
Yeah.
But you needed to know, you the reader needed to know what this was that he was going to be facing. He even became ready to do it.
Yep.
I wrote this book really in the shadow of what happened on January 6th. It was in my mind. It's not a book about January 6th. I try to explain this to people. It's not a polemic. Mm-hmm. It's not about present-day politics, unless you wish to draw some conclusions about them. And insofar as it is, I think of it as being about the very fine and uncertain line between civilization and barbarism that exists in any society, but including ours. And I think we as Americans have, against all evidence really, tended or wanted to think that the rules of other countries' history don't really apply to us. Now, I don't mean to imply that the events of January 6th were anything as barbaric as the Klan, which it was. It was deeply sadistic, vicious, and led, and this is pertinent, as you know, since you've read the book, and largely led by people who regarded themselves as the elites in the communities where the Klan grew. The Klan was not just a gang of ignorant hillbilly thugs, which is what I think even some of their supporters preferred to suggest, that decent people weren't really responsible for this horrendous brutality that the Klan visited on mainly African Americans, but also white Republicans. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, I think certainly, as far as this book has something to say about our present moment, it really has to do with the fact that we're closer to the edge, I think, of chaos and disorder and danger than many Americans would like to admit. And the story of the Klan and Grant's grappling with it tells us just how close we can get and how bad it can get if we're not paying attention to what we're becoming.
Yes, I think you make the point splendidly that it takes sustained action to keep alive a noble endeavor like the freeing of African Americans, and that at some point people just got tired and they allowed the extremists to seize a moment. And there were, for sure, the radical Republicans in Congress who were urging Grant on. But it really is a story of presidential action. An attorney general, was his Major Miller? Was that his?
Well, Amos Akerman was the attorney general, Major Lewis Merrill is the courageous army officer you're thinking of.
Yeah. That old saying that we used to have in the 60s, that all it takes for the forces of evil to win is for enough good people to do nothing. That's what I came away from. Did you know going in the kind of, what do you call barbarism, the kind of atrocities? The list of things that happen are soul-wrenching.
Yeah, I had a general understanding of it, and in some areas, very specific knowledge of it. But one of the most valuable sources, I think actually the single most valuable source I used, was the 13 volumes, just an astonishing set of records of the Congressional Joint Committee's investigation of the Klan, which took place in 1871. 6,000 pages of very, very small type, including the testimony of hundreds and hundreds of people, largely, but not exclusively, victims of the Klan, and largely African Americans. It was the first congressional hearing that ever took testimony from African Americans or from women. Mm. Lots of women's voices. And there are people testifying who've walked 50 miles to be heard. People who were killed after they've testified because they testified. And it's extraordinarily rich and, frankly, unnerving sometimes. Many of the crimes that the Klan perpetrated are horrendous.
The savagery, yeah.
Savage. Yeah, they're absolutely savage. They're barbaric and they're sadistic.
Yeah.
And as a writer, I thought a great deal about how to handle a lot of that material, which often not just borders on, but tips over into kind of the pornography of violence.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. But I don't censor anything. I don't believe in it. I don't like it. And I figure people need to know what happened. This is not a subject that permits a euphemism.
Yep.
And in addition, so many of the victims of the Klan, African-American victims in particular, have no voice otherwise. They only have a voice in these records and some others, the Freedmen's Bureau records as well, and in personal letters to Ulysses Grant. If you read his letters, they are equally as wrenching. People are writing to Grant from all over the South, from hamlets in virtually every former Confederate state, describing what's happening to them, describing their fear, begging for federal troops. And this is why Grant acts, not just because it's finally he's got a muscular, radical Republican majority in Congress that wants him to act, because it's good politics to the extent that the future of the Republican Party is perceived at the time to be in the South. African-American voters,
yep.
They need to be protected. But Grant is personally moved. He's personally moved. He's a remarkably sensitive man for a military man.
Yep.
He cares. Yep. He genuinely cares about what's happening to people. And he's capable of a sense of affinity and even identification, I think. He's a man who's had a rather difficult life in some respects. Not the life of a sharecropper in Mississippi, but nonetheless, he can relate to people.
Yeah, it's a great story of him selling cordwood on the streets of St. Louis before the war, and then 3 years later, he's a major general.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
But he had the makings of that major general all along,
And
circumstances liberated his potential.
Yeah.
He was very fortunate.
Yeah, the tragedy is stunning, especially for African Americans, in that there was this moment of promise where you had black congressmen and black senators, and you had black majorities in several states to guarantee rights, and the vote is given to black men in the South, and there's a counter reaction from the racists and the white supremacists, and then you have a president who's on your side and responds. You have a passage of a Civil Rights Act and three Reconstruction Act, and then all of a sudden, it's, I guess if you had to put a finger on it, it would be the Supreme Court decisions. But from that point on, we're into Jim Crow, and all that hope is crushed, and it goes on and on and on for 75 years.
Yeah, if I'm pressed to put my finger on a pivotal date, it's one that is not typically recognized, but it was the watershed, which is the generally not much remembered election of 1874. What happened in that election? The Republicans lost control of the House of Representatives. All money bills originate in the House of Representatives. Democrats, who were, sad to say, the reactionary party of the time, and in the South they were beyond reactionary, absolutely would not pay to maintain federal troops in the South or to pay for court costs for the prosecution of Klansmen. They wouldn't pay for enough federal prosecutors to go down and ferret out the Klansmen. Yeah. Now, thousands of Klansmen had already confessed and been arrested. Comparatively few were finally prosecuted because of that, because the money wasn't there. This isn't the sexy side of history. It's the money side. Yeah. And money, as much as any other single factor, subverted the great promise of Reconstruction. Simultaneously, a lot of Northerners are losing interest.
Yeah.
They're getting tired of the South. They're getting tired of Black Southerners.
Was there a feeling that, okay, the Klan's back is broken?
Yeah.
We can just move on now because we got the bad guys, not realizing the depth of racism?
Yes. Even Frederick Douglass says the Klan is broken. He says it's over in 1874 or 5.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Frederick Douglass.
Yep.
And if you want to look to anybody to get a true sense of what the state of things is, at least for African Americans, you look to Douglass first. Well, Frederick Douglass was actually not sitting in Mississippi or Alabama. He was sitting in Boston and New York and touring Europe, and it wasn't the same Frederick Douglass as a commentator.
Right. Now, at this time, Grant's political enemies were getting some success in painting him as out of touch and his administration as corrupt. And there's two ways to look at Grant. There's like the old corrupt drunk, or there's the new hero of civil rights, which has come to vogue in maybe the last 20 or 30 years. I thought you very delicately spelled out not just the triumph of his will, but then all of a sudden the sort of stepping back, the loss of momentum that also happened inside the White House. So in the history books, he's been on this amazing roller coaster. He's gone up and down and up and down. He's on the way up now. But this was, I think, a very realistic portrait. He was an American president that had flaws and that just lost the political support and the ability to continue the prosecution.
Yeah. I mean, Grant, of course, as you know, as we all know, was a paramount victim of lost cause ideology, which began during his own presidency. He was, of course, demonized by reactionary Democrats, but he was also demonized by would-be reformer Republicans. They called themselves liberal Republicans, but they were actually the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Forget about the definitions here. It's a little confusing. But his own party undermined him because he didn't belong to the traditional political class. He was not from the Northeastern elite. And his reputation was destroyed, frankly. Was there a considerable amount of corruption during his administration? Yes, there was. It's documented. That's not arguable. Grant himself was not corrupt. Was he sometimes a poor judge of his allies? Sometimes he was. At the same time, he was heroic in the sphere of standing up for civil rights. Heroic, politically heroic. And here was a guy who was not a natural politician, but who was able to combine his military training, personal grit, fundamental uprightness, and he learned how to do politics not all that well, but well enough to carry out this campaign. Very successful against the Klan. Did his values change? No, they didn't. His values didn't. He was undercut politically. He was also, frankly, he was tired of Washington.
I got the sense of fatigue, I got the sense also, I think you said naively at one point, he thought that there was enough people of goodwill to let it carry forth.
Yeah, not only Grant, plenty of right-minded Northerners thought that once the dragon of the Klan had been slain, and so it seemed, well, that wasn't going to happen again. I mean, there's abundant documentary material explaining what people were thinking. It's not mysterious. And at the same time, there was an intense desire in the North to believe wrongheadedly, naively, and desperately wrongly, in fact, that if Southern whites, former Confederates, regained all their pre-war rights, even if they were allowed to re-enter politics as they were, well, they would calm down and accept the new political order, the revolutionary political order that Reconstruction had bestowed on them. It was wrong.
Yeah.
It was just flat out wrong. It was political wishful thinking, not the only instance of it in American history.
And then a couple of years later, you get the corrupt bargain of the election of 1876, no?
I'll challenge that. That's actually the subject of my next book.
Oh, excellent.
So tune in. And
I had to cross out that question. What are you working on now?
Tune in about 2.5 years. But for a short answer, I don't think it was a corrupt bargain at all. I think it would have been, frankly, from a purely hard-headed political point of view, if I can step into the shoes of the forward-looking, liberal-minded Republicans of 1876, Tilden would have been a catastrophe. Samuel Tilden, the Democratic candidate, representing the still reactionary Democratic Party.
Yeah, for listeners, we might want to explain that it was the election that was a tie.
It was a negotiated tie.
Yeah.
It was certainly negotiated. But the deeper one digs into the actual politics of the vote counting and the politics of the Electoral College and so on, it seems fairly clear to me that the outcome was correct and not corrupt, even though it's often said to have been corrupt. It is true that Tilden won more popular votes.
Mm-hmm. Lincoln, obviously, was willing to prosecute that war and at the end of the war to abolish slavery. But he also spoke about healing the wounds on both sides. And I think that Grant came away with that same sort of philosophy, at least at the beginning, that he could get people like James Longstreet, the Confederate general that came over to the side of light. But in the end, it was almost foolhardiness to believe that the South could change. What is it about that Southern character at that time? Was it economics? Was it feeling of far more than regional pride? If you can, I know it's a very complex series of psychological adjustments that have to be made, but talk about how racism and the need to justify slavery had perverted an entire chunk of the American people.
Well, that's exactly the right way to frame it. Is there a one-word explanation for why the South could not come to grips in an honest and moral way with the revolutionary transformations of Reconstruction? There is a one-word answer. It is racism. Deep-seated, ingrained, unrepentant racism and an entire ideology built around it, an all-encompassing ideology that had been cultivated for a couple of generations. And if you were to ask me if what American political figure may have done the most to turn the crudeness of racism into an actual intellectual system is John C. Calhoun, very famous South Carolina senator and a statesman, but a statesman who did not believe in democracy. And he believed absolutely in white superiority and was an intellectual. And I'm mentioning him here because a whole architecture, an intellectual architecture of racism was built in the 19th century, in no small part in reaction to the moral tide of abolitionism and anti-slavery, which is growing in the North. And it was perfectly obvious that slavery is immoral. It's obvious to anybody. And Southerners had to work very, very hard to create a system that was sufficiently plausible to themselves.
Yeah.
To justify what they were doing to, by 1860, about 4 million men, women, and children. The truth is they believed in it. They thought it was great.
Yeah.
It was the economic underpinning of most of the Southern economy. It was the source of an immense amount of wealth when you measure people, human beings, in dollars.
Yep.
Sure, there was hard-headed interests, but they also believed in it. And this is the hardest thing today, I think, for us to really grasp, that they thought it was fine and they explained it to themselves through utilitarian philosophy, through readings of the Bible, through an appeal to ancient philosophy, many different ways, and to so-called scientific racism. This is a rich and terrible subject that deserves to be written about more, frankly, to understand why a huge part of the white American public was so committed to believing in slavery and the corollary that those who were enslaved must deserve it somehow.
Yeah.
Or are benefiting from it. And pro-slavery, there's an abundance of pro-slavery writing.
Yeah.
It's tough stuff to read today,
yeah.
But I think it's really necessary to understand what this thinking was. So that didn't just go away because the Confederate Army was defeated in 1865. Who might be culpable after 1865 for doing the most damage to Reconstruction? Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor as president. Lincoln's worst decision as president, in my opinion, was allowing Johnson onto the ticket. He made small bore political sense in 1864.
Crude Southern Democrat from Tennessee.
Yeah, he was actually a very interesting political figure if you can take slavery out of it. That's challenging to do. But Lincoln's first vice president was Hannibal Hamlin of Maine. This man is not a household word, but he was an eminent and much respected senator from the state of Maine. He was an abolitionist, and a Reconstruction overseen by abolitionist Hannibal Hamlin from Maine would have been a very different thing from that overseen by Andrew Johnson from Tennessee. Johnson, essentially almost from the beginning of his accession to the presidency, is telling Southerners, white Southerners, welcome back. I mean, he's anti-slavery, Johnson, but he is deeply racist.
Yeah.
And these things are perfectly compatible, sad to say.
And then to tie it all up, then, getting back to history, you get the Lost Cause dream philosophy, which allows the South to continue, and the statues go up all over the place, from Monument Street in Richmond and everywhere. Talk a little bit about how our history was sort of seized, and this story, which you tell about in your book, sort of forgotten and buried for almost 100 years.
Almost 100 years. Yeah. Well, okay, by 1877, the year that's usually cited as to punctuate the end of Reconstruction is 1877, and let's call it the negotiation that resulted in the Republican Rutherford Hayes becoming president and federal troops returning to their barracks in the South. They were not just pulled out from the South, but there were hardly any left.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about a million men. We're talking about maybe 9,000, most of whom are in Texas harassing Indians. But they were no longer going to be used to protect elections. That's the crucial detail. They stayed in the barracks. And the other thing that happened in 77 was that the last former Confederate states lost Republican governments, state governments. It was the Republican governments in various former Confederate states that were really driving Reconstruction on the ground. And that's where African Americans were really holding office, a couple of thousand, probably more than that, in various Southern states. And once these so-called redeemers, that's what they called themselves, redeeming white supremacy, once they were back in power, they were in a position, one, to control nearly all aspects of elections, courts, constabulary, and essentially to rewrite history, which they did. And it must be said, though, that the most influential school of Lost Cause historians actually was centered on Columbia University in New York City. Known as the
Dunning School.
The Dunning School of Historians.
Yeah.
Professor Dunning was from New Jersey, but he had absorbed Southern sentiments about Reconstruction rooted in racism and a complete revision of what had actually happened. If you look clearly at the history of Reconstruction, You see tremendous dynamism, a burst of energy to rebuild the southern states on a democratic basis. Was there corruption? Of course there was. It was America in the 1870s. So was there corruption? Of course there was. Was it extraordinary? Not particularly. Was it what southern whites claimed? No, it wasn't. They rewrote history. Yeah. Because that suited the ideology that sustained white Southerners in a quasi-totalitarian system. When I say that, that's not a word that's usually used. But African Americans in the South lived in a totalitarian Jim Crow world.
Yeah.
We can see it in other countries. We don't want to use a term like that in the United States, but it's what it was. And indeed, it was pretty similar to that for whites who wished to deviate from the system or dared to challenge it. Although they were not in the same kind of physical danger. And this became a national myth. Birth of a Nation, the famous, brilliant, but infamously racist film of 1915.
Yeah. Lightning on the screen.
Yeah. It was popular everywhere. By then, 1915, it became a national way of looking at Reconstruction. And that survived in textbooks in plenty of places up to the 60s. The state of Alabama had on its ballots, at the top of its ballots on election day, said white supremacy. 1960!
Yeah.
Later than 60, actually. But Americans accepted this as a given. I mean, within my memory.
Definitely within our lives, anyway.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much for writing the book. Thanks for showing up with us here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Jack.
That was author Fergus Borderwick speaking with fellow biographer John Farrell about his latest book, Klan Wars, Ulysses S. Grant and the Battle to Save Reconstruction. It was published in October 2023 by Knopf. We recorded this interview at BIO's annual conference at the Leon Levy Center in the City University of New York in May of this year. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.